The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
What does selling out mean? How is the term used by blacks and whites in America? What are its effects on individuals and on our society as a whole? Tonight, Randall Kennedy, author of the controversial bestseller Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, grapples with another stigma of our racial discourse. Kennedy, author of Sellout, The Politics of Racial Betrayal, was himself accused of selling out. And tonight, in conversation with Gregory Rodriguez, he'll give us a first-person reckoning of what that accusation meant to him and how he dealt with it. Randall Kennedy is one of the most sought-after media experts on the topic of race in America. A professor at Harvard Law School, he is also the author of Interracial Intimacies and Race, Crime, and the Law. He received his undergraduate degree from Princeton and his law degree from Yale. As a Rhodes Scholar, he served as law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. In conversation with Professor Kennedy tonight, we have Gregory Rodriguez, who, as many of you know, is founder of the popular Zocalo lecture series. Gregory is a former MSNBC political analyst and currently a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's director of the California Fellows Program and a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, a nonpartisan public policy institute. The Economist has called Gregory a journalist who is decisively changing the understanding of Latino experience in the United States. Gregory recently spoke here on the Aloud series on his new book, Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America, which was just named by the Washington Post as one of the best books of the year. It's a lively, provocative, and in-depth examination of the largest immigrant group in American history. So please enjoy this evening's program, and please join me in welcoming Gregory Rodriguez and Randall Kennedy to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Sorry to disappoint you, but it's just me. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm really honored and pleased to be sitting here with Randall Kennedy. I've just read the book, and it's so clearly thought out, and it's so fair-minded, and it's Randall Kennedy, and I'm pleased to be here. What I wanted to know knowing that I was going to meet you was simply how a nerdy Harvard law professor became a best-selling author. How did that happen? Tell me the secret.
I was very lucky. The way it works in legal academia is that you write articles to get ahead, and these articles appear in law reviews. And I did that for a number of years. And I wrote an article in the Harvard Law Review, which was excerpted in the Wall Street Journal. And a man by the name of Errol MacDonald called up and said, I saw your piece in the Wall Street Journal. Why don't you make a book out of this? And I said, okay, fine. And he sent me a contract the next day, and I wrote a book. It was a book called Race, Crime, and the Law. And I enjoyed doing that. I mean, it's fun to write law review articles, and you get feedback from law students, and you get feedback from your fellow law professors, but nobody else much reads law review articles. But lots of people read books, and I got...
It's all relative.
Well, you get feedback from all sorts of people. So I like that. And then I started writing other books, and... So that's how it, that's how it happened.
You mentioned Errol MacDonald. Tell us a little bit about your editor. We happen to share an editor. I'm really trying to get gossip out of him right now.
Well, I mean, Errol MacDonald's an interesting guy. He's an editor, as you know, at Pantheon Books, part of the Random House empire. He's one of the few blacks in sort of elite publishing. I like him because he gives pretty free rein and lets you go where you want to go. And he has been a very supportive editor.
And you've published 4 books with him.
Yes, I've published all my books with him. Yeah,
I think when people look at the title of your book, and they might expect that you're going to be against this notion of belonging to a group, and against the notion that you can be a sellout to a group. But I think one of the more fascinating things about when you dig into the book is that you said there is when you belong to a group, one can be kicked out, and there are times and instances in which that is merited. And could you help us understand when are those times? What is a sellout, number uh-huh. one, and why is there value to the idea of that notion?
Well, first, on what is a sellout? People mean different things when they use the term sellout. Some people just use it willy-nilly as, you know, they just use it to disparage somebody with whom they disagree. But when people are being a little bit more serious, they often have the idea of a person who is committing treason against the group, a person who has betrayed the group. And so, therefore, I mean, that's a very harsh indictment. It's a very stigmatizing label. Now, every group is worried about abandonment. Every group is worried about betrayal. The United States government is certainly worried about abandonment or betrayal. That's what the Department of Justice, you know, there are lots of people in the Department of Justice who are very concerned about internal subversion or treason. Every group polices its boundaries. I don't care if it's a family, I don't care if it's a union, a government. Every group is worried about, has this anxiety about betrayal. And every group has boundaries. As soon as you label a group, as soon as you say black Americans, well, you've created a group. If there are some people that are black Americans, that means there must be some people who are not. And every time you create a group, you create a boundary. Some people can do something that's outside of the boundaries of the group. And if they're in the group and they go far enough outside the group, they are going to be sanctioned. So I think that if a group is to maintain its groupness, it has to patrol its boundaries. So yes, I think that there is a place for the sellout label. There's a place for a notion of group treason. What I say, though, is that we need to be very, very, very careful in using that sort of language and imposing that label.
Could you tell us some instances within African American history in which that label was merited?
Was merited?
Yeah.
Sure. I'll give you a couple of instances. So, slaves who informed on impending slave rebels for purposes of, you know, getting a suit of clothing, getting a pittance, or just mere revenge, or bringing it closer to our own time. We know, as a matter of fact, that Martin Luther King Jr.'s accountant, the chief accountant for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was a man who, on a monthly basis, reported to the federal government namely the FBI, on Martin Luther King's finances. And he did this not for ideological reasons, but simply to get some money. Or give another example. Oh, there were hundreds of big, I mean, in the 1960s and 1970s, I mean, there were literally thousands of, you know, informants who infiltrated the Black Panther Party and other places. Again, not for ideological reasons, but for purposes of getting money. Let me give you one other example. One of the more memorable people who I encountered in my research for this book was a man by the name of William Hannibal Thomas. William Hannibal Thomas was a black man, fought in the Civil War for the Union, who in 1901 wrote one of the most vicious anti-black diatribes of the era. It was widely lauded by white supremacists as being a brave expose of the inferiority of the Negro. This black man's book was widely condemned in black communities, from Booker T. Washington on one side to W.B. Du Bois on the other. And so these would be people who, in my view, deserved ostracism, intense ostracism, and deserved the label of sellout.
At the same time, after you established the notion of insider and outsider, and the moments in which the term sellout is merited, you also discuss the problems that coercion, that all collective activity requires some coercion, and the effects that coercion might have on people within the group.
Yeah. Well, I just gave a couple of examples of places where I think the sellout title was warranted. Let me give a couple of examples of very prominent black Americans who've been called sellout. And one of the claims I make is that practically every successful black American has at one time or another faced the prospect of being called a sellout. So let me name a couple of people who've been called sellout. Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, probably the great abolitionist, probably the most well-known black activist of the 19th century, was called a sellout. Why was he called a sellout? He was called a sellout because he decided to marry a white woman. His first wife was a black woman. They had a long marriage. She had helped him to escape slavery. They had a long marriage, produced several children. She died. Then he married a white woman. Well, this caused absolute furor within black circles, and he was roundly condemned, and there were people who said, Frederick Douglass has now abandoned the race. Let me give another example. I mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois, probably the most esteemed black activist intellectual of the 20th century. When the United States entered World War I, Du Bois wrote an article in The Crisis, the great journal of the NAACP. It was an article called Closing Ranks. And in this article, Du Bois said, listen, during the pendency of this war, black people ought to get behind the United States government and pitch in and help out with the war effort, and they ought to temporarily shelve their protest against white racism. Archibald Grimke, Monroe Trotter, and others just thoroughly condemned W.E.B. Du Bois. They called him a black Benedict Arnold. One could go further. Obviously, in our own time, the person whose name is virtually synonymous with the term sellout is Clarence Thomas. And, of course, Clarence Thomas is, well, Clarence Thomas is the most vilified black official in all of American history.
Let's wait a moment.
The longest chapter.
Let's build up to Clarence Thomas.
All right. But in any event, these are people who have been called sellout. And like I said, and I might add another person who's been called sellout. Namely, yours truly. And, of course, that's one of the reasons why I was sort of interested in unpacking this word.
Well, now that you've led into that, tell us about two questions. Broadly, what is that notion? What is it? The fact that you're saying that every successful African-American has been accused of being a sellout. One, what are the overall effects this must have? And two, what was the effect on you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll answer your question by throwing another name into the mix. It's a name that's on many lips now, probably the most exciting person in American politics, Barack Obama. Barack Obama, from the outset of his historic campaign for the presidency, has been dogged by a suspicion in some precincts. Now, I don't want to exaggerate it, but in some precincts there has been this suspicion that Barack Obama is not sufficiently loyal to Black America. And the thinking behind it goes something like this. Barack Obama has obviously a lot of white support, fervent support on the part of some whites. An appreciable number of black people look at that and say, whoa, why do the white folks like this Negro so much? I mean, something's wrong. Something's wrong with this picture. Do they like him because he's selling out? And that dynamic occurs, I mean, this is, you know, in the political arena, but it occurs in schools, it occurs in workplaces,
the effect that if you're going to if you're doing your best, even if you're well intentioned and you're moving ahead, as I assume you are yourself, what effect must that have on your psychology, the way you see yourself, the way you see other African-Americans? There must be some long-term insidious effect of being called that.
It has many effects, and many of them are profoundly detrimental. So one effect it has is if you know that you stand to be labeled a sellout, you may do a variety of things in order to avoid that label. You may decide that you're not going to distinguish yourself. You know, if you're gonna, for instance, be called a sellout, if you go to college, other folks in the neighborhood are not going to college. And you go to college and you're going to be called a sellout, maybe you decide, well, I'm not going to go to college then. If you're going to be called a sellout because you take advanced placement subjects, I'm not going to take advanced placement subjects. I'm going to, you know, be with my boys. In the political arena, if you stand to be called a sellout because people are attracted to you, you may do things in order to signal that I'm not, you know, don't call me a sellout. Obviously, I'm, you may run up the black flag. Don't dare call me a sellout. But of course, if you run up the black flag, then it may very well be that there are going to be people who might otherwise have been attracted to you who are not going to be attracted to you.
In your epilogue, you discuss the effects on some of your students at Harvard Law, and could you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. One of the reasons behind writing this was, you know, experiences I've had with students. I've had students that decided that they did not want to pursue, who did not want to pursue careers as, let's say, a prosecutor, because they did not want to be called a sellout. I've had students who said that they were interested in being trial attorneys. What should they do? Well, if you want to be a trial attorney, maybe you want to think about being a prosecutor, because after all, prosecutors get a lot of trial experience very fast, and you get a lot of really good training. I've had students on several occasions say, I can't be a prosecutor. I'll be a sellout. I'll be working for the man. And
what do you find wrong with that when they say that to you?
Oh, I find lots of things wrong with that. I mean, first of all, prosecutors are probably the most important single actors in the administration of criminal justice, probably more important than judges. I mean, prosecutors are the ones that charge for crime. So they're incredibly important. And so what these students are saying to me is that for fear of being called sellouts, they would be willing to cede these important positions to other people. And I say, listen, why wouldn't you want to grab hold of the levers of power afforded to you by this position and make the administration of criminal justice more equitable, more sensible? I've had students in the third year, law school's 3 years, so these are students who are on their way out. I will have taught them in the first year. I will have taught them contracts in the first year. I wouldn't have seen them for 2 years. They're on their way out. I'll see them. You know, Miss Smith, it's good to see you. What are you getting ready to do?
You call them all Miss and Mister?
Yes, I do.
All right.
Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah, it's just sort of it's a formal mode of presentation, but I sort of like it.
All right.
So, Miss Smith, what are you going to do? Miss Smith, black student, will come over to me and very quietly say, I'm going to work for, and it'll, you know, there'll be a name of a law firm, very distinguished law firm, but she'll be so angst-ridden about it, so have such a guilty feeling about it, that she'll whisper where she's going to work and say, and I don't plan to be there long, I just plan to be there long enough to pay off my student, you know, loans. At which point I say, listen, if you want to do something else, do something else. You know, you should pursue happiness. But don't feel that you, don't disable yourself from working for this place just because you have this feeling of guilt. For goodness sakes, if you want to be a lawyer and pursue, you know, corporate taxation, or you want to be the counsel to corporations, if you want to be the managing partner of Cravath, Swain & Moore, or Covington & Burling, if that's where you find fulfillment, do it. And don't be, you know, don't have this survivor's guilt, this angst, this self-limiting fear that people will say you're abandoning your community because you want to pursue this or that career.
You mentioned early on the boundaries of any given community. I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about the definitions of blackness and the history of passing, which one of your more compelling chapters talks about.
Well, The book begins with a chapter. Actually, it was a chapter that was suggested to me by Errol MacDonald. I turned in the manuscript, and he says, I like the manuscript, but I think you ought to begin the book with a chapter called Who is Black? Because there's a difference between an enemy and a sellout. An enemy is a stranger to the group. A sellout is somebody who's in the group and is an enemy of the group. But in order to call somebody a sellout, you first have to determine they are part of the group. That raises the question, well, who's in and who's out? So if you're going to say that a black person is a sellout, you have to say that that person is black. Well, who is black? You know, who is black? And of course, this has come up with, again, Barack Obama. You know, his mother's white. Why isn't he white? Or why isn't he, you know, multiracial? Why, you know, what makes him black? So I spend the first chapter discussing various ways in which, over the course of American history, blackness has been defined.
And could you give us some examples of different definitions by state, for instance?
Yeah. Well, here's one. One rule, probably the most well-known, one criterion for blackness, and it's probably the most well-known, is the so-called one-drop rule. The idea that one drop of black blood makes one black. So any discernible African ancestry makes one black. And as a matter of law, by the way, there are a number of states that determined, that had that as their definition of blackness. Any discernible African ancestry made one black. But that's just one conception. In the state of Virginia, you were legally white up until early in the 20th century, so long as you were not more than one quarter black. And there were other states too that allowed people to have some discernible African ancestry, but nonetheless legally be white.
That really held, though, in a place like Virginia?
Yes. In fact, in 1924, Virginia resorted to the one-drop rule when it passed the Racial Integrity Act of 1924. And there was a big debate in Virginia about this. A very interesting debate. And because Virginia, over time, kept narrowing the definition of whiteness. And at one point, there was a legislator who got up and said, you know, if we keep messing around with this, there's not going to be any more white people left in Virginia. For instance, there was this huge furor over the so-called Pocahontas exception. Some of the leading families, white families in Virginia, were very proud to trace their lineage back to Pocahontas. And so the authorities in Virginia said, okay, we'll let you can be white so long as you didn't have more than, and I think it was 1/16th Indian blood. But then there were some people who objected to that and said, well, the problem with that is we're going to have these light-skinned Negroes claiming that they, you know, descended from Indians. So there was this huge fight in Virginia. And actually, there are hundreds of cases throughout American history that have litigated the issue of just racial identity.
Speaking of leading families in Virginia, could you tell us about the children and grandchildren of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson? It's a fascinating story.
Well, there you have a perfect illustration Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings had a relationship. Of course, in black communities, it was fully accepted over a long period of time that Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings had a relationship and produced children. Amongst leading white historians, that was rejected. I think more recently, it's become general consensus that yes, they had a relationship, yes, they had children. And it's very interesting to follow the history of those children. Some of the children passed and decided to become white. On the other hand, some of the children decided to become black. And you have these interesting stories. So, for instance, during the Civil War, there were members of the Hemings family. One in particular enlists in the Union Army. And he's told, well, you can enlist as a white man. And he refuses. He insists on enlisting as a Negro soldier. And this happened on down. The same thing happened later. Same thing happened in World War II in the Hemings family. So again, this whole question of, you know, who is who is a lot more complicated than people think. One of my earlier books, Interracial Intimacies, I spend a lot of time discussing some of the litigation that arose in various places, including in this state, over the questions of, you know, of blackness. So you'd have these fights, and you could understand why that would be so. I mean, after all, until relatively recently in American history, you know, I mean, owning a gun in the antebellum period, black people were not allowed to own guns. So somebody would be arrested, charged with the crime of being black and owning a gun. Defense, I'm not black. Or many states, including this one for a long time, it was a felony for a black person and a white person to marry. One defense would be, this isn't a mixed marriage. We're both white, or we're both colored. Then there would be this fight, there would be litigation over, well, what are you? And those were absolutely fascinating. And so things would come out like, there were experts. Experts would be called, you know, anthropologists. And they would look at things, well, take a look at the complexion of the person's skin. Let's take a look at the hair. There was one case here in California, it was extraordinary, where a beautician was called to the witness stand. It reminded me of the ads long gone from television, but the ad that I think was for Breck, you know, only your hairdresser knows for sure. And the question was, you know, how did you set this woman's hair? In other words, how kinky is it? Width of nose, breadth of lip. There were certain tests. There was a notion that black people were said to have had a certain curvature of the foot. It was called the Negro foot. There was this idea that black people had a certain sort of half moon at the bottom of their fingernails. Go on and look. I know that people, go look. That's right. And so this is actually a facet of American law that has largely been obscured, but it's a tremendously interesting subject.
Now that the audience seems to like you, let's get to Clarence Thomas. Is Clarence Thomas, by your lights and by your definitions, a sellout?
No.
Why? Or why not?
Okay. Clarence Thomas is a...
See, people are already heading for the doors over there.
Clarence Thomas is a very conservative black justice who takes positions with which many blacks strongly disagree.
Including yourself.
Including myself. I have strongly disagree with Justice Thomas about all sorts of things, including the central subject for him, and the issue, the litmus test, the reason why so many people are against him in the black community is because of his position with respect to affirmative action. I think he's wrong. I mean, he thinks affirmative action is both unconstitutional and a bad policy. I think he's wrong on both counts. I think that that there's nothing in the federal constitution that prohibits affirmative action, and I think it's, on balance, a good policy. So I disagree with Clarence Thomas, and I think there's good reason to disagree with him. But is he a sellout? No, I don't think that Clarence Thomas is a sellout. Clarence Thomas sees himself as a race man. He wants to advance the interests of the black community.
And you argue that because you've read his decisions and he states.
Absolutely, he says it all the time. He says, you know, affirmative action is bad for black people, and that's one of the reasons he's against it. Now, let me just drop a little footnote here. There is a certain inconsistency with Thomas saying that because he's constantly talking about the colorblind constitution, colorblind constitution, colorblind constitution. I feel like jumping up and saying, Justice Thomas, since you believe in the colorblind constitution, why do you care whether this policy is good for black people or bad for black people? It should be immaterial to you. Nonetheless, he's constantly talking about how affirmative action is bad for black people, and that's one of the reasons why he's against it. For purposes of this discussion, it seems to me that's a very important thing. It matters to him. His reputation among black people, it matters to him. He feels tremendously hurt that, you know, so many black people revile him. Now, there's another reason that, because I don't think motive can, you know, can be the whole thing. There's another reason why I would say that I don't think that Clarence Thomas should be called a sellout. And that has to do with this. It's difficult to figure out what's in the interests of a group. I mean, black Americans are a large group, a very diverse group. You've got affluent blacks, you've got poor blacks. You've got blacks scattered all over the United States. Blacks have all sorts of ideological positions. Black community is complicated. It's internally, you know, divided about a variety of things. Against that backdrop, it's very hard to say so clearly what's going to be in the interest of this complex group. So I have friends that I respect very much who are against affirmative action. Do I want to take the position that being against affirmative action in and of itself makes you an enemy of black people? 15% of black Americans are probably against affirmative action. Do I want to take the position that 15% of black Americans are enemies of black America? I disagree with them. But that doesn't mean that they have to be my enemy. And I think we need to be very careful to distinguish foe ideological opponents from enemies. You call somebody a sellout, you're talking enmity. And I think you better be very careful before taking that step.
One of the more effective arguments you made was when you're comparing gays and African Americans, and the instances in which a gay partisan can actually do harm, and you also at some point say African Americans are no longer in that situation.
Yeah,
could you explain that a bit?
Well, one of the real benefits of working in a university is that you have these audiences, captive audiences, otherwise known as classes, and you can float your ideas. And so in floating the ideas that end up in this book, there were a number of students who pushed me hard on my definition of sellout. And a number of them said that gosh, by defining it so narrowly and demanding such clear proof, I was essentially making it a null set. They said, you know, you're theoretically keeping the category, but you're not putting any black people who are living in it.
That's a fair critique.
And I think, it's a fair statement. I wanted to know, well, and they suggested that I was getting rid of the category of sellout, but not saying so. And so I thought, well, how can I make clear that I truly do believe that there can be a category of sellout, but there are just, you know, no significant instances in black America today. So what I thought was, okay, let's analogize black America and gay America. There are gay people who have contributed to explicitly anti-gay policies and politicians. I thought of Terry Dolan, one of the leaders of the New Right, who assisted organizations that were explicitly anti-gay. Or one of the leading brains behind Jesse Helms was a gay man. In fact, he recently was married. He and his partner in Massachusetts. A gay man backed Jesse Helms, despite the fact that Jesse Helms was probably the most vociferous anti-gay politician in the Senate. Gay activists unmasked these political operatives, outed them, and called them sellouts. In my view, they are or were sellouts. And I don't object to what the gay activists did vis-a-vis them. They ought to have been severely ostracized. The question I ask, are there analogs to Terry Dolan and this other fellow whose name I've now forgotten? Are there analogs in Black American life? And the answer is no. Is that because Black Americans are more virtuous? No, it's not because Black Americans are more virtuous. It's simply because American politics have changed. There is not a market for expressly anti-Black politics, though unfortunately there is still a market for explicitly anti-gay politics.
We are going to take some questions, I think, Mr. Kennedy. We'll take some questions, and I will, there's a microphone that you can, oh, I get to call on people. Please.
Hello. Would you please expand on your last comment about there not being any, did I hear you correctly, any specifically anti-Black? I think my mind boggled. Any specifically anti-Black agents?
What I said was there is not a market for expressly anti-Black policies. The state of Florida says that gay people are not allowed to adopt. Uh-huh. Every state of the union says that gay people, there's only one state in the union that allows gay people to marry.
Mm-hmm.
In the armed forces of the United States, you cannot be outwardly gay and be a member of the armed forces. And mm-hmm. One could go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. There are no such analogs for race. That's what I meant to say.
Okay.
I'm not saying that there's not racism in the United States. Okay. There is.
Okay.
But fortunately, there is not express official anti-Black policy in the United States.
Although
I just wanted that clarification.
There are policies that may have disproportionate negative effects on Blacks.
Yes.
And it doesn't qualify for you that if someone supports one of those policies that has detrimental effects on, let's say, 25% of African Americans, that wouldn't count. Supporting a policy with the detrimental effects on, let's say, 25% of African Americans doesn't count as being someone who's seeking to hurt African Americans.
I don't want to get unduly technical here,
go for
but
it.
As a matter of federal constitutional law, if a policy is intended to burden a racial group, it is in violation of the federal constitution. That's a very different thing with respect to gay people. Unfortunately, there are government policies which intentionally burden gay people, and under the, you know, as the law currently stands, that's okay.
Sir.
Just to mention the other obvious name, I mean, there are two names in this country that are connected with thoughts of being sellout. Thomas is one, but we can't leave out California's favorite, Ward Connerly. Mm-hmm. And it would seem to me a definition that would not include Ward Connerly needs to be looked at carefully. I mean, I say that because here's a guy who has benefited tremendously personally only because of his stance on issues that seem at cross purposes with African Americans' well-being. So I just wondered, how does he fit in your universe? And it would seem to me that a definition would, and I'm not into personal attacks, but just in terms of his role mm-hmm. in society, I mean, we do have to be able to talk about a person like him mm-hmm. and decide how to think about him.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy to talk about Ward Connerly. I don't think there's all that much difference between Ward Connerly and Clarence Thomas. There is a distinction between them in the following. Whereas Clarence Thomas does view himself as a race man, I don't think that Ward Connerly does, because I think Ward Connerly seems, at least in some of the things that he said, to want to get rid of the idea of racial boundaries altogether. I would say, with respect to Ward Connerly, you know, I disagree with Ward Connerly about a lot of things, but do I see him as an enemy of Black America? No. No, I don't. And I don't think, I mean, what, I don't see what's wrong with saying I disagree in the strongest possible way with this person for the following five reasons. And then, you know, go down those reasons. I'd rather do that than use a label which all too often, as far as I can tell, just leads to a sort of shortcut way of putting down somebody. I disagree with Ward Connerly, but I don't think that is he committing, you know, sort of racial treason? No.
Sorry, I got confused. Right here, please.
I'm very intrigued by what you said about what are the ramifications of the label of mm-hmm. selling out, that individuals may make decisions to not take a job that they really want to do or not go to college. Those examples that you gave. And I find that's a very interesting tension with what seems to be a driving force in American culture, the myth of the American dream, that the individual has the right to advance him or herself. And that's an interesting tension. Mm-hmm. Would you please address that?
Well, I mean, it is a tension. And we see in a number of communities, and by the way, let me state this again. I think I said this, but let me emphasize it again. I'm speaking in this book mainly about Black Americans, but the phenomena that we're talking about shows up in other groups as well. People, you know, other groups also manifest self-defeating behavior. Almost, in some instances, fear of success. So I'm not saying that, you know, Black Americans are peculiar in this regard. Now, is there a tension? Sure, there's a tension. On the one hand, there is the idea of, you know, upward mobility, going for it. We, you know, rags to riches, Horatio Alger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's part of our American, you know, mythos. On the other hand, don't forget where you come from. Stand by your community. Don't forget your roots. These two things, people will say one in the morning and the other in the afternoon. And so, yes, there's this tension. It shows up in American society at large, and it shows up in Black America. Yeah.
Sir.
My question is about your views on affirmative action. Mm-hmm. I've listened to Dr. Claude Anderson, and he kind of talks about the ambiguity of the terminology, kind of setting it up, whereas it doesn't address a specific crime that would be addressed. And being ambiguous, it kind of sets it up for the attacks that it's been under, whereas if you use terminology like the Holocaust, that's for a specific crime during a specific time, and you're addressing it with a policy, it's not as easy to attack it. But affirmative action is kind of a terminology that's ambiguous, so, you know, and I just kind of want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the term affirmative action is ambiguous, and it's ambiguous on purpose. Proponents of affirmative action, and I am a proponent of a proponent. I'm for it. And people who are for it have used terms which are, you know, strategically ambiguous. So there's lots of different ways you can refer to affirmative action. In fact, you can very often tell where somebody is on the affirmative action issue by noting how they describe a policy. So when we talk about affirmative action, what are we talking about? Racial affirmative action. We're talking about policies which are expressly intended to benefit a given group. Blacks, let's say, for instance. Now, you could, proponents use the term affirmative action. Opponents say reverse discrimination. In England, they use the term sometimes positive discrimination. There's various, nowadays, on many in many areas, people don't even use affirmative action. I'm dating myself by using it. Nowadays, people talk about diversity. So there are lots of different ways of describing these various policies. And one of the reasons for the various, you know, for the variety of names is, you know, a purposeful ambiguity. There are all sorts of justifications for affirmative action. You mentioned the Holocaust. Oftentimes when people sort of analogize or, you know, talk about the Holocaust vis-a-vis affirmative action, they'll say, well, you know, there's reparations for various crimes that have been perpetrated against various groups. Why can't affirmative action be a type of reparations for Black Americans? Obviously, Black Americans have been tremendously mistreated in the United States. Given that backdrop, why not have affirmative action as a type of reparations? My own view is that, for the most part, the basic impulse behind affirmative action has been reparative justice. But then there are people who don't like that justification because they say, well, you know, what about other people who've been mistreated in the United States? And what about the mismatch? What about, you know, there's some, you know, what about the problem of, what about the problem whereby the people who seem to benefit the most from affirmative action are precisely those who are in the, you know, who've been least hurt by historical injustice, and on and on and on and on. One could go on for hours discussing the affirmative action issue. Let me just end this by saying that I'm basically for it, but it seems to me that it has to be acknowledged there are arguments against it. And these arguments against it do have some weight. And in discussing the issue, it seems to me that ought to be acknowledged. One other thing, and it came up with the gentleman over here with Ward Connerly, and I want to get back to him because he said, you know, Ward Connerly has benefited from affirmative action, which he undoubtedly has. And one thing that's really terrible is having benefited from it, now he wants to get rid of it. Ah, okay. I didn't understand you then.
He's benefited as being a spokesman against it.
Okay.
He's benefited tremendously because of his role.
Okay. Two things. One of the central criticisms of Clarence Thomas is that he's benefited from affirmative action. He sort of used the affirmative action ladder, and now he wants to kick it out from other people. That's one thing. And then yours is Ward Connerly has benefited from being an anti-affirmative action spokesman. On both points, people use that against Thomas and against Ward Connerly. I frankly don't think that either argument is particularly good. With respect to Ward Connerly, he's benefited from being a spokesman against affirmative action. So, I mean, for that matter, my former boss, the great Thurgood Marshall, benefited from being a spokesman for the NAACP. I mean, just because somebody is benefiting from something doesn't tell us about the merits of their position. He could be benefiting from it, and what he's saying could be right. I think he's wrong, but just because he's benefiting from it doesn't damn his position, as far as I'm concerned. With respect to Clarence Thomas, people say over and over again, you know, Clarence Thomas has benefited from affirmative action. He shouldn't speak against it. Well, what about white people who have benefited from white supremacist policies? What, you turn around and say a white person who's benefited from segregation ought to be disabled from repudiating it? It doesn't seem to me that that's logical. What seems you need to talk about the substance. Is affirmative action constitutional? Is affirmative action good for the society? Not whether Clarence Thomas has benefited from it or not.
I'd like to ask just a real brief question. You mentioned, it seems to me that one of the more persuasive arguments for affirmative action is reparations.
Mm-hmm.
But now increasingly, I think the University of Michigan used it in its arguments for affirmative action, it's diversity. And
yes.
You mentioned that shift. And when you talk about diversity and it's good for the diversity for the school to have minority students. It seems to be implied that it's good for white kids.
Yes.
So, what do you make of that shift from reparations to it's good for white kids to have blacks and Latinos around?
People.
That's essentially what the University of Michigan argued.
Yes, and the proponents of affirmative action have been under tremendous pressure for 30 or 40 years. Way back in 1976, the Supreme Court of the United States and we're in California, and the Bakke decision essentially said you can't make reparations arguments. So if you were a backer of affirmative action, you can't make reparations arguments. You had to go back to the drawing boards and say, okay, well, gosh, I want to keep affirmative action afloat. What kind of arguments can I make? And so very smart lawyers said, okay, we can't make a reparations argument. The Supreme Court is not going to recognize that. We'll make another argument. Affirmative action is good for universities because it creates intellectual diversity and there'll be better learning in the classroom. The Supreme Court went for it. Now, frankly, you mean to tell me that it's a more powerful argument to say that people will learn better if there are all sorts of different people in the classrooms? That's a better argument than the argument of trying to repair 300 years of oppression? That doesn't make sense to me, but it floated with the Supreme Court, and, you know, that's what we've got.
Thank you very much for answering that. I'm wondering that for years. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, you mentioned early when Mr. Rodriguez, Mr. Randall asked you for your definition of the sellout, and I think you used the example from David Garrow's book on Dr. King, Bearing the Cross, about this individual who was undercover for J. Edgar Hoover working against Dr. King. I would like to ask you when, I think Juan Williams, when he was working on the biography of Thurgood Marshall, he discovered in the Freedom of Information Act that that Chief Justice Marshall also worked for J. Edgar Hoover. What would be the difference in those two definitions?
I'm glad you brought that up. Happy to. Let's be careful here, though. Thurgood Marshall never worked for J. Edgar Hoover. What Juan Williams pointed out in his biography was that from time to time, Thurgood Marshall did cooperate with the FBI in sharing information about people who were suspected of being communists. Thurgood Marshall was a fervent anti-communist. Fervent anti-communist, and saw nothing wrong with cooperating with the FBI to some extent in ferreting out communists and seeking to isolate them. That's what Juan Williams showed in his biography. And I know there's, you know, some people, I'm sure, who'll be very critical of Thurgood Marshall for taking that position. But it should be clear, he was not paid. It was an ideological position that Thurgood Marshall took. It was an ideological position he took in part because of his experience with the Communist Party in the 1930s and the 1940s. Now, that is to be contrasted with the man who, purely for money, kept tabs on Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Let me go further in your question, though, because, and this gets to the complexities of betrayal. One of the most fascinating episodes I came across in doing research was an episode that occurred in the 1920s. And it, too, involves J. Edgar Hoover, interestingly enough. In the 1920s, J. Edgar Hoover recruited blacks to infiltrate Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. They infiltrated, in fact, it was thoroughly infiltrated by black agents of the precursor to the FBI. They infiltrated Garvey's organization, and then when Garvey was prosecuted, they testified against him. He was convicted, led to his deportation, etc. Well, it turns out that we actually know a lot about these agents, and they were asked later, why did you infiltrate Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association? Why'd you do it? And a number of them said the following. We did it because we thought that Marcus Garvey was leading black people astray. We thought Marcus Garvey was leading black people, over the cliff. Now, it seems to me that this actually poses a real, a difficult issue. Because if what they are saying is true, that is to say, if they're sincere in their beliefs, that what they were doing was ideologically motivated, then we have a real complicated thing. Then what they're saying is, we were informing on Marcus Garvey to help the black community. Not to hurt the black community, to help the black community. And so, you know, what assessment does that make? Let me drop a footnote here. At the very time that they were doing this, one ought to recall what W.E.B. Du Bois was saying about Marcus Garvey. W.E.B. Du Bois was saying that Marcus Garvey was the most dangerous figure, was the most dangerous foe to black people in the world. So, you know, against this backdrop, exactly what does one say? It is very, very murky.
You got a comment? Oh, wait, the microphone's coming around.
Thank you. When you started off, you said that you were also one of the persons that was sort of hated too, like Clarence Thomas, and you didn't elaborate too much on that. But I want to go back to the question of affirmative action. Does it not seem that affirmative action appeases the oppressor, and therefore you did not get what was rightfully yours? So for 100 years to go, people will still be arguing against affirmative action because it's like a band-aid on injustice.
Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting point that you make. People have forgotten nowadays. I mean, nowadays people think of opponents of affirmative action as being, you know, solely people on the right of the political spectrum. In the 1960s, late 1960s and early 1970s, they were critics of affirmative action from the left, saying exactly what you just said, that affirmative action was a type of, was a strategy of co-optation, that what was behind affirmative action was essentially throwing some bones to the black bourgeoisie, cool them out, and don't change much. You know, fine, University of Michigan and all these other, you know, universities, let in a few black people. You all can get some nice jobs. We'll let you into the power structure. And as for these other people, now let's all coalesce and have a consensus that these other people who are rioting are just rioters and they are illegitimate. There used to be a left critique of affirmative action. For somebody who, I mean, I think, for instance, the best case that I know of for that position, by the way, I disagree with that position, but the best case I know of for that position, and I think it has some merit to it. Just because I ultimately disagree with it doesn't mean that it doesn't have some weight. I think it's something that needs to be grappled with. But there was a man by the name of Robert Allen who wrote a book called Black Awakening in Capitalist America, which took just the position that you just articulated.
I'm told we have time for one last question. Okay, you two. Two more. Don't do that to me.
Why do you feel that affirmative action has only been criticized when it involved minorities, but when it was alumni or donors or like our present president, for very wealthy people, affirmative action was very good?
Yeah. The sort of what people who are opponents of affirmative action would say, remember, I'm a proponent of affirmative action, but if I were the mouthpiece of the opponents, what they would say is, listen, race occupies a very special place in American life. Nepotism, is okay. Nepotism is okay. We have, distinctions based on earning capacity is okay. When you fly on a plane, if you're willing to, if your bank account can stand to pay, you know, first class, you can be in first class, and all the poor people have to get in the back of the plane. And, you know, the American framework, that's okay. There are all sorts of distinctions drawn. If you are the if your parents went to a school and you're preferred on that basis, that's okay. Those are distinctions drawn, but they're not racial distinctions. What the critic, what the opponent of affirmative action would say, what's different about affirmative action is it's explicitly racial. And these other things are not explicitly racial. Therefore, they're not as problematic.
Last question.
This one's for you, Gregory.
Oh, Lord. Next.
Got you. You must have had to deal with the label of sellout yourself. I mean, once it became...
Moi?
Yes. I mean, once it became apparent early on that you were going to get educated, you probably heard from all the Rodriguezes in Los Angeles that you were betraying them in some way. Did you deal with it head on, or did you avoid?
I knew you were bad news. I knew it. Shockingly enough, I had to deal with it very little. You know, Mr. Kennedy, as he says, African American are often portrayed in the media as very uniform, but they're very heterogeneous, and so are Mexican Americans. You wouldn't know it by reading the paper, but what I found was people like coming out of the woodwork saying, "Yeah, man." And I saw people saying, "I mean, for instance, when I wrote, I was young once." And I, David Hayes Bautista and I wrote in the Los Angeles Times an obituary. My God, it was 1996, an obituary for the Chicano movement. And everybody said, "Oh, they're going to kill you." A lot of it was like almost hyping up the old, you know, the old guard, like what they were going to do to you. And when I wrote it, it was mostly people coming around saying, "You're right." You know what I mean? So a lot of it was, you'd think they would have gone after me, but it just... kind of, and I hate to leave. We're gonna have one more question because I don't want it to end on me. Okay, and that was not nice to Mr. Kennedy. And it's gonna be like opportunist, right? This woman's raising her hand already. So no, I think I've actually you'd be surprised how few people. And I got a lot of allies really quickly. They were scared, but in a sense, you know, the whole point is to take advantage of the liberty we have as intellectuals, and when you see someone else say something that was brave, it kind of emboldens you. And one of the really, and to bring it back to Mr. Kennedy, I mean, he talks about his own advantages of being at Harvard Law, and he talks about what a sellout can, what the term can do to you. I mean, if you're a young writer with no institutional backing, it could wipe you out. Really, but once at a certain point they can call you that and it doesn't really matter anymore. You know what I mean? So if you have to get somebody young and scare them and hurt them, it's really more of a hurtful term, right? That's meant to, it doesn't really do anything. They don't take away their, you're not gonna, you know, throw rocks to your house. They're not gonna burn your car. They're just gonna hurt your feelings, and you're gonna say, "God, I better not say that again." You know what I mean? It's like screaming at an umpire. It doesn't change the call, but it makes the umpire think, "Shit, I better not do that next." Or maybe I get a bad call to the other team. But anyways, next and last question. Sir.
Mr. Kennedy, could you share with us a little bit of the influences that have been the most powerful in your life, family, education, individuals, whatever?
Well, certainly the most important people in my life were my parents. I come from Columbia, South Carolina. I was born in 1954. My parents were refugees from the Jim Crow South. My parents left Columbia, South Carolina because my father was afraid that if his kids were mistreated in the way that he saw so many of his friends' kids mistreated, he would kill somebody. So he left. And I went to Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., I'd say that the most important, other than my parents, the most important influence in my life was the high school I attended. I attended a school, St. Albans School for Boys. And at St. Albans School for Boys, I met a group of people who have been with me for the rest of my life. I met classmates, a very distinguished one who's right here in this hall right now, who were wonderful classmates.
I'm sorry, we're really all looking around. Do you mind?
There's the classmate right there. all through high school. It was a school, very elite school. There weren't, the black population of the school was small. My teachers were all white. Some of my teachers, one in particular, just died this year. Best teacher I ever had. A man by the name of John F. McCune. He's a history teacher. And they were wonderful. I had squabbles with my teachers about some of the issues we're talking about today. But that was a wonderful, really a transformative place for me, St. Albans. I've been lucky throughout. I've attended wonderful schools. I went to Princeton, which was, again, a wonderful place. But throughout my life, I have encountered people of all racial backgrounds who have been very supportive. And I think that has had a tremendous effect on me because through example, I see that people can have, you know, cross-racial empathy, cross-racial love, and it has made me believe that we can and we shall overcome.
Randall Kennedy, it's been an honor and pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And I'd like to remind everybody that copies of Sell Out are available for sale outside. It's a fantastic book, and pick one up. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed it.
I did.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the law firm Arendt Fox. Media support provided by KPCC 89.3 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.